Welcome to Norpod Law Series 6, Episode 6, recorded on the 1st of November 2012. Responsibility. That was a bit weird, wasn't it? Responsibility.
Everyone can do that, you know.
I know, I'm rolling my R's. Gotta be getting careful, Jonathan. Come on, we've got a serious show on now.
It's the cake and bourbon show. Well, it's actually the red wine and chocolate muffin show.
I know we've got a guest on, you see.
But it is a serious topic.
Absolutely.
Yes, obviously the guest isn't drinking and eating chocolate muffins. That is just us.
I know I am. Quite happily, as it
were. I don't blame you. That voice, listeners, that you may be unfamiliar with is Lexi Ellis, award-winning blogger, if you don't mind. Writer of the Mummy Woo blog. Which awards now?
Best new blog in the UK for 2011 and best blog post on postnatal depression and depression for 2012.
Not bad going there. We had somebody who emailed us once and said that they thought our show was all right.
Yeah.
That was a good start.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
It was obviously his mum, but, you know.
Yeah. Even better.
Whose mum was it, Kirsten?
No.
It's enough secrets. Enough on that story. Alrighty, so welcome to the show, Lexi.
Thank you. Yep.
We've got various things to come up during the course of tonight's show. We're recording on a Thursday rather than a Wednesday, so we could avoid Halloween, because we were all doing terribly exciting things. What did you do on Halloween?
I didn't take my meds, so...
So it was scary.
Wow. Interesting evening all around.
Scary for everyone.
Really.
That's what that howling was, I think.
Yeah, it was, actually.
Alrighty. So we're going to be talking about a couple of interesting cases later on, a judicial review regarding CRB checks. You may recall on last week's show discussion on the subject of disclosure and when consultation had to take place. A bit of an interesting case on that, just been published. We've got a case of mathematics and juries coming up as well, all a bit peculiar, and although Jonathan's giving us that story, I dare say Kirsten's going to attack the maths on it.
Kirsten's found this case, and I'm quite excited.
It's not really that mathematical. We don't want the.
It can be though.
Well, it can be. only if once Jonathan and I have got hold of it, it can be remarkably mathematical.
It should have been.
But the point of law is not mathematical,
no.
Particularly.
Fair enough.
So you may be able to follow it, Liz.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You're looking at me. And also, if we get time to get to it, a case called Williams, which discloses some.
I can sum that up in about 2 seconds if we have to. So we'll should be able to fit that in.
Excellent. But before we come to that, then the recent case of Boots. In fact, she does have a first name as well, which for this precise
Felicia.
Second, Felicia. Thank you so much. I had it written down and I couldn't put my hand on it. Has hit the headlines recently. This is, in fact, Kirsten, tell us a little bit about it.
This is a case, I think to some degree it's a case of infanticide, although she wasn't charged with infanticide, she was charged with murder, and the jury found her innocent of murder but guilty of manslaughter on the basis of diminished responsibility. She was suffering from postnatal depression, and as a result, it was found, of that illness, she smothered her 14-month-old daughter and her baby son. It's all a bit sad. And I think Lexi's very much got a bit of peaked about it, really, haven't you?
I have, really, a little bit, yeah. I think the first thing that I don't like the way it's been reported is that she is commonly reported as a mother with postnatal depression, and nowhere in any of the... in any of the journalism that I've managed to read on this, does it mention anywhere postnatal psychosis, which for me is...
Sounds a little bit more likely.
There are two separate illnesses at stake that, you know, involved there, to be perfectly honest, in my humble opinion, both of which I've suffered. And to be able to kill your children and have... And I do believe that there is a diminished responsibility. I think that it is psychosis, not depression. So that's the first thing that annoyed me, and the lack of support that was there involved.
Well, let's just deal with that distinction first. So for listeners who don't understand that there is a distinction between those...
Postnatal depression, you've got 2 years, haven't you? You're likely to come on in the first 2 years after the birth of a child.
Well... I suppose that's statistically, yes. But there are cases of it where it can. I know cases of it where it can be any time up to 7 years, 8 years after the children have been born.
Mm-hmm.
If it's gone on undiagnosed and untreated.
Yes, it can go on. Mm-hmm. If it's undiagnosed, it doesn't really go away of its own accord.
And sometimes it doesn't if it's diagnosed.
And that's rather different from sort of the baby blues.
Immensely.
Yes.
Yeah. Immensely.
Sorry.
I'm backing off.
Questions come to us.
Immensely different from postnatal.
Yeah, so baby blues, most mothers suffer at some point. That generally gets better as sleep kicks in.
That tends to be day four, when you tend to have a meltdown because there's no tea bags and you sort
had
of have
enough
one of those,
now.
Yeah, Michael Douglas moments. But yeah. Is it Michael Douglas?
Falling down.
Yeah, falling down, exactly. Excellent. What do you mean there's no tea bags?
And then we move to postnatal depression, and again, that's rather different from the psychosis.
Yeah.
So, symptoms of psychosis?
Yeah, what's the difference?
Apart from killing your children, obviously.
Yeah. Psychosis is, I guess, is where the diminished responsibility, I would say, for me would definitely come in, is that there is absolutely no self-awareness of the way you are behaving.
Right.
For example, when my son was born, it was the 4th of April. God, I nearly forgot his day of birth then. But it was Easter Sunday. Now, I'd been awake for 5 days in labour. And after he was born, I made a joke, oh, maybe he's Jesus. And before I knew it, I had a psychiatric team around me in the ward because they were concerned that I had psychosis. I managed to say, obviously convince them that it was a joke and what have you. But those thoughts didn't leave. You know, I put on a very good show. I didn't want my baby taken off me, and I was terrified that they would. But in the dead of night, when my other half had gone home, I started thinking, well, maybe he was sent here to test me, and maybe this is what it was. And for me, that's the difference between depression and psychosis. I wasn't having... and then, before I go on to that, I was at home thinking that perhaps he was... Unfortunately, my brother died a number of years ago. Maybe he was my brother reincarnated, and he was here to punish me. That... For me, a psychosis, not depression. Those thoughts were fleeting, but there were times when I would have to get out of bed. If I was lying in bed, because he slept in the bed with us, and he would wake up and look at me in the middle of the night, and I'd be looking at him, and in one moment I'd be looking at him with love, like, oh, you know, this is fabulous, I've got this little boy. And then in the next moment I'd be, I need to leave, because actually I feel like we're on dangerous territory. I don't trust my own mind. Now, I feel quite blessed or grateful that I actually had the self-awareness to do that, to think, actually, what you're thinking, Lexi, isn't normal, and actually you need to walk away and you need to go and gather your thoughts and come back when you've had some sleep or what have you.
Which actually makes me think that probably isn't psychosis on that basis, because the problem with psychosis is that generally you have absolutely no concept at all, and the symptoms usually are that you are violent, not just necessarily towards your child either, it's often towards other people around. It's a proper I don't mean that other forms of postnatal depression are not proper mental illnesses, but it's akin to schizophrenia and things like that, the psychosis, whereas postnatal depression can be horrendous. I mean, you know, it isn't the baby blues, it's absolutely horrendous. It's sitting there thinking you're completely worthless, it's, you know, you want to die, you can't cope, you're not managing this, you're the worst mother in the world. All that falls under the category of postnatal depression.
Plus, I was diagnosed with postnatal psychosis and depression. Mm-hmm. There are elements of postnatal depression that are not just about the feeling, I agree completely, but not just about the feelings of worthlessness and not being a good mother, but actually this is where the psychosis, and I guess there's a spectrum of psychosis.
Yes, I think that's got to be right, and similarly with postnatal depression.
Yeah, because... you know, I think the self-blame leads to other things, low self-esteem, of course it does, and that's categorically depression.
Yep.
But then immediately that can lead on to... I mean, I was immensely paranoid. I was paranoid that everybody who came into contact with my son was coming into contact with my son to prove to me that I was a terrible human being who deserved to die.
Hmm.
I was lying in bed in the middle of the night, and I would put the baby down, put my son down after feeding him, and look at him and think... Oh my God, he's going to kill me. He's going to grow up and he's going to strangle me and he's going to kill me. I need to put a stop to this now. And I would have to get up and walk away. Now, I was quite lucky because I had quite a strong support network. And I was lucky that I had the self-awareness. But I suppose in the case of Felicia Boots, is that the reality is that she, for me, 100% had psychosis and not only the depression, because for me, there, having been, I mean, I was sectioned for 5 weeks. I was in hospital for 5 weeks under a voluntary section and on antipsychotic medication and everything, once it all came out in the open and this was, you know, became apparent, this is what I was suffering with. That to say that this lady had only postnatal depression and this is what she's done, I just can't believe that. And also some of the pointers with her as well, and there's obviously a lack of support.
Well that's what I was going to ask you, is in Felicia Boots' case, what do you look at? I mean, obviously we have to go only really from what's been published about about the case, and I know that her partner has made quite, well, he's actually given quite a lot of commentary about it. I think a family friend has as well. What, in your mind, are the sort of pointers that it was more than postnatal depression?
For a start, I mean, some of the pointers there early on, that she'd had no family, there was no support there or what have you. She's come out of hospital.
That's a big issue for her, I think.
Yeah. And there's a lot mentioned about religion as well, that she'd left a religion. She was a Jehovah's Witness.
Had a failed marriage.
For me, there was
she had to leave.
Confusing disappointment there, what have you.
And she had a brother that committed suicide as well previously.
Yeah.
So there's a history of depression in the family.
I think, for me, the main point of that it was psychosis is that the husband... it has been reported that the husband got home and found her curled into a ball on the bottom of the staircase, and she'd written a note saying she can't believe what she'd done, but she was unable to walk, and she was fully, I mean, it says that she was fully aware of what happened, but she couldn't believe that she'd done it. Now,
she couldn't explain it.
She couldn't actually remember doing it, and for me, that's psychosis. I mean, you have to look at the, you know,
sort of temporary or maybe sustained, sort of almost an alternative reality to her.
Yeah, I mean, I would...
I think that is the trigger for psychosis, isn't it?
Yeah.
In any case, not just postnatal depression.
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, it's a different league completely, but I mean, I would have moments of just complete no self-awareness. My other half would come home from work and I would have... I remember once I'd commandeered his credit card and he'd come home from work and I gaily informed him as he walked through the door that we were going on a round the world trip on the Friday, and this was a Tuesday afternoon, and Addison at this time, who's my son Addison, he would have been about 4 months old, and he said, have you booked this? And I saw the panic slowly sort of dawn on him, and I was like, yeah, I have. Aren't you excited? How can you not be excited? And when he was, well, I have work, babe, and you know, we can't go around the world with a 4 month old, I took that personally. How dare you not want to do this with me? You are doing this on purpose. You've set me up to fail. I am so much more than this person. But devastated that he was the worst person in the world to put me through this hurt, and I'd gone out of my way to do this nice thing, $8,000 on his credit card, such a nice thing that I did for him, that in my point at that time, sitting on the sofa on my own while the baby slept, was the most natural thing in the world to do. How would she have not, in those moments of complete madness, have thought that what she was doing made complete sense? She smothered her babies to stop social or child protection services coming to get them. In her mind at that time, that was the only thing she could do to protect them, and I understand that.
The reason she thought that was because she was given medication, so this had been recognised. So she was supposed to be taking medication, and she didn't because it would affect the breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I take issues with people who say, oh, it's all, you know, it's the culture of breastfeeding and everybody feels pressured into it. And I have to say, that's not ever been my experience.
Well, she'd also been given...
Then that, I would say that from my point, that would be why that's your experience. As somebody who didn't breastfeed, I have the opposite experience to that, which is interesting, I find.
It's relevant here as well that she had been given some reassurances by her GP that the particular medications that she was taking would not have had an impact in terms of a child.
That's right.
Although, of course, maybe that's possibly another pointer in the direction of the psychosis rather than simply the depression.
Can I say something at this point about that? I was given antipsychotic medication and antidepressant antidepressants from my consultant psychiatrist before I was put into hospital under consultant and day therapy that I was told that I needed to do. I didn't take my medication either. Why? Because I knew I was poorly, but because that was an admittance of guilt that I was a horrible, evil person. And that was a failure. If I took this antipsychotic medication, I'm not psychotic. I just think my dog's possessed. You know, but I wasn't psychotic and I'm not a failure.
That's not particularly related to mothers. That's a general theory quite frequently that we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
But I can understand that might have been another reason why she didn't take the medication.
It seems to have been, doesn't it? Seems to have been that she was terrified that the social services would come in and take her, either because she wasn't taking her medication, it was never quite been very clear, or because she was taking medication.
Right.
Perfect.
Can I just ask, in relation to the episode that you've described where you bought that round the world trip, you were diagnosed with both postnatal depression and postnatal psychosis.
Yeah.
Which of those two, this might be an obvious answer, but which of those two do you put that down to, the moment in time where you thought that was a good idea? Do you put that down to the psychosis?
I put that down to both.
Right.
Because I don't feel that... I wasn't actually diagnosed with psychosis until I was in hospital.
So this was before that stage?
Yeah.
Had you been diagnosed with postnatal depression by that stage?
Yeah.
Right.
I had.
Right.
And that's not unusual with people with depression, is it? It's just like a manic depression.
Not.
It's fairly, fairly usual.
Not. Yeah, I mean, I was... I had at that time. I had no understanding. I could not understand how what I'd done wasn't normal. I people do this. What's wrong with you? You've got, you know, you're so boring. Stop being a geriatric.
And that's the psychosis side of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well. So in Felicia Boot's case, the outcome of that was that she was given a hospital order. We've talked about them before on the show, but in short, it's not a prison sentence. It is a disposal, to use the other expression for it, that means that the person will either stay in hospital until such time as they can be safely released, or in certain types of hospital orders, until such time as they are mentally fit to then rejoin a prison population, subject to assessments by the Mental Health Board.
It's one of the things in this case, there's been various comments about the fact that she's got away with killing two of her children. You think, yeah, seriously? Because a hospital order, that's a really easy stint, isn't it? Let's go and live in a mental institution for a couple of years or, you know, a few months or whatever.
To give some perspective on that, it's often the case that, and I'm sure that people around this table have got more experience of this than I have, that sometimes you might have a defence on the table that you're perhaps less than willing to consider because it may result in a hospital order, and
that's
a hospital
not what
order
your client wants.
Can sometimes be a greater deprivation of liberty than an equivalent prison
sentence. Well, there's no, you know, you, especially on something fairly low level, not something like this, but something low level where you could spend a few weeks in prison.
Or even years.
Well, you could spend a few weeks in prison, or you could get a hospital order, which has no end.
Well, indeed,
because you don't know when they're going to say you're well.
Which is why I say even a few years, because you can have cases where years of imprisonment can be preferable to a hospital order, because a hospital order carries this concept of, you just don't know.
No.
And it's a difficult position.
I think, just in terms to give a little bit of context, that the judge sentencing this matter, Mr. Justice Fulford, said he described a prison sentence as a disposal as being wholly inappropriate when he made that order. He described it as an almost indescribably sad case. He said, although the roots of Mrs. Boot's actions were profoundly tragic given the loss of two such young lives, what occurred was not what most people would regard as criminal activity. I'll come back to that perhaps in a second. He went on to say, I unreservedly accept that what the defendant did to the two children she and her husband loved and nurtured was solely the result of psychological and biophysiological forces that were beyond her control. He effectively sort of separated that from neglect cases and cruelty cases that, as he says, that sometimes come before the courts. Just to go back then to his observation about what the public perception is. Clearly this is a tragic case, but he says that this is not what most people would regard as criminal activity. That's quite a difficult assertion to make unless you are entirely, well, I suppose if you take the view that psychosis effectively literally is a temporary, complete and utter loss of your own mind, as it were, or your if it's separated into two, your normal mind. In other words, is it simply not criminal? Is there no criminal culpability there simply by virtue of the fact that it wasn't her as she is herself? It was the psychotic version of her,
can't
if you like.
Be, in some ways, that can't be right. I know Lex will probably have a view on that. That can't be right, because otherwise she would be pleading insanity.
Well, quite. That's what I'm sort of hedging towards, yeah.
Which, interestingly, would probably result in the same method of disposal.
Almost certainly.
But no criminal conviction.
Mm. Lexi, you're not a lawyer. Any thoughts?
I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. It's just so difficult. I read, you know, some of the comments that people have left on, and I just don't know. All I know is, as a mum, and having experienced nothing like what she's been through, but episodes of psychosis where I feel like I've not been in control of what my behaviour has been, is that when I have come round from periods of psychosis, there is an instant where you think, what just happened? And then you think, oh my God. And it hits you like a train.
From your point of view then, does it strike you as would you describe it as criminal? Because that's what the judge is saying, that normal people wouldn't think of this as criminal behaviour.
Would I describe this as criminal? No, absolutely not. But I'm not a lawyer. I have no legal background. As a mum who's had psychosis, who's a bit opinionated after a glass or two of wine. I just noticed my glass.
What's your view about it going through the criminal courts? It's about her being dealt with by the criminal courts?
No, I think the disposal. There's me using my first ever legal word. Is correct, is that she shouldn't have an end date for when she comes out. It should be based on her mental capability. I completely agree with that. I think you put this lady, from my point of view, you put this lady in prison and she's let out in, I don't know, how long would she get?
Well, who benefits from that?
Life, maybe?
If she were given a prison sentence, it would effectively have a tariff attached to it, meaning that she would have, I would imagine...
25,
well, it would depend, wouldn't it? Because in this case, it would have been manslaughter anyway.
That's true.
The first thing that comes to my mind is when I see this picture of her with her kids, and now that I think her kids are dead, and having experienced nothing like she's experienced, but on a tiny maybe frame, and having been in hospital with women who were in similar situations to me, all I want to do is give her a hug. Because for the rest of her life, when she's in sane mind and she's medicated, she has to live with the fact that she's never going to see her children ever again, and that's her doing, and that's her fault, and she has to live with that guilt for the rest of her life. Is prison necessary? It's a psychotic episode, or it's postnatal depression. There's medication. She can have talk therapy. She's going to be in the hospital. They're not going to, it's not like you said earlier, it's not an easy get out clause, as many people seem to think. Exactly. So she's going to have the treatment that she needs, but she's going to suffer for the rest of her life.
So are you quite relieved to discover that that's how the courts deal with people like this?
Relieved? I don't know whether I'm relieved. I think it's compassionate.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, compared to the alternative methods of disposal, such as prison, I mean, a lot of people might think that the courts would be of a different view.
Yes, this is it. You get punished. That's what happens when you go to court. And actually,
you have killed,
often not.
You go to prison, and obviously that's not the case.
But do they? I know it's I know it's totally different. But these people that want to go to Switzerland and end their lives for an illness, do they punish those people? I don't think they do. This is an illness. And that's my point. I know that's a totally different thing.
They possibly do prosecute them. Yes, there aren't very many prosecutors. prosecutions. Well, they don't generally prosecute the ones, obviously, who go for obvious reasons.
Well, let's just broaden this up a little bit, because the a very key feature to this case is the fact that she had previously been medicated and for whatever reasons had taken herself off her medications. That is something that that we encounter in the criminal justice system relatively frequently. Those who would, generally speaking, be asymptomatic if they were regularly taking the medication they should be taking for one reason or another don't. And it's usually a fairly swift downward spiral into psychotic behaviour. I wonder perhaps whether the answer in cases of people who are in long-term mental health treatment, is there perhaps an argument that the mental health treatment itself should be closer, more closely scrutinised, monitored, if there is a real danger that without the medication there may be a predilection towards criminal activity or worse, this type of criminal activity. That's an expensive option.
It's incredibly expensive option, and there lies the problem, I think.
Well, that may well be the answer, but what do you think, Lexi? Is that something that perhaps, although it's by far away the more difficult way of dealing with things, is that something that you think may prevent people in this situation being dragged into the criminal justice system?
Oh, it would never get to that, would it? So, yeah.
But
you then finish up, don't you, with potentially more people through the family courts, because you then finish up, how are you going to do this? You're going to finish up realistically with the social worker coming round, and then we're back to square one, aren't we? If now I've got a social worker who's involved, and if I put one foot out of line, my child's going to be taken into social services care. And if that's your worry to start off with.
So that could be the trigger in the first place.
Indeed. I think it's very tricky, actually.
I don't know whether it would need to, I mean, certainly, again, I can only talk with postnatal depression, but I think it wouldn't need to come to that. If the health visitors and the people that were meant to take care of your welfare and take care of the child's welfare immediately after the birth, in some cases, did the job that they were there to do in the first place. Mm. I mean, I was sitting on the sofa sobbing when my health visitor turned up, and she gave me a piece of paper with, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel about this? And on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel about this? And on a scale of 1 to 10, how useless do you think these scales of 1 to 10 are? Because actually, I'm just going to tell you what you want
to say. Well, it's about a 2, yes. Yeah. Yeah, clearly,
you've walked into my house. I have a pair of knickers holding my hair back. I've not slept for 6 weeks. I'm sobbing, and you're asking me, are you sure you're okay? I mean, the reality is, and then when I did admit I am, and this is just my personal experience, I'm a bit suicidal. It was the first time I'd ever said it. I'm having suicidal thoughts. I'm not sure whether this is normal. I was assured that the health visitor would come back and see me every day for a week. I never saw her again. And in my state at that time, I took that personally. And that was another reason what led me to overdose. Because, I mean, and that's the thing. I don't know whether do we need to get to a point where it's legally required to take your medication, or do the people that are doing their jobs just need to do their jobs, and they need to change what's out there already? A scale of 1 to 10. If a health visitor had sat in front of me and said, are you frightened? I'm going to take your child off you if you tell me that you're feeling low. I just said, yeah. And if she'd have said, well, I'm not, that's not what I'm here to do, I'm here to look after you, then I might have been more inclined to be honest.
It's difficult, isn't it? Right. Because you just, from health visitor to health visitor, it's always going to be a personal issue. You get some extraordinarily good health visitors, and you get some,
agreed.
You do in any job. I think it's
but should there not be an automatic trigger a health visitor discovers that sort of scenario?
You might think you're a bit surprised that's something that just
scale of 1 to 10 are just completely useless. I mean, really there should be a case where I think it should be mandatory that they say, are you worried I'm going to take
the
child
it's not that. I mean, the 1 scale to 1 to 10 are always still there. You go for triage at an A&E if you've got a high breath. You've got a high pain threshold. You get treated after somebody with a less serious injury who's
on a scale of 1 to 10, how broken is your leg? Fairly broken. A 5.
I don't know. I'm not the doctor. How serious is it? I haven't got a clue. But it's...
And also the stigmas. It's not just about you being frightened that you're going to get your children taken off you. I think it's the stigma that you think it's a choice. I felt I was a selfish, horrible human being because I couldn't stop crying. And then I was...
But then that, of course, is part of the nature of the depression.
Right. And then I had it rammed down my throat that it was probably just baby blues. So then I was like, it's just the baby blues. It'll pass. And he's a year old by this point.
Yes. I think the other problem you have with postnatal depression, etc., is this fact that it can come on for any time in 2 years. Yeah. Most people, you can be coping brilliantly brilliantly, and therefore the health visitor isn't visiting you
anymore,
because you know there's no reason for a health visitor to be coming every week or every day for 2 years. That would be horribly intrusive, and then one day it triggers. And
but I mean, I took myself to A&E at one point.
And again, you think that maybe that might have been a bit of a wake-up call for somebody.
Right. Nothing was done. I was sent home with a, you know, are you taking your medication? Yes. We'll see how you feel tomorrow. And if you still feel as low as you do now, then come back. And 2 days later, I took an overdose.
What is interesting in this case, I think, is that one of the things that the papers have gone on about is that she lives in this, you know, rather nice area.
She's
Middle-class Nappy Valley. But actually, I think that is, I think that is quite interesting, because if you are suffering symptoms and you're in that sort of area, I suspect you get rather better treatment normally. Because I think people, I think there's probably less of it in terms of just general problems of the area most of your clients come from. You know, criminals come from all spectra of society, but they do, of course, have areas where they're, you know, you've got less money, less educational backgrounds, all that kind of thing. It is true, I'm afraid, that, you know, a lot of those stereotypes.
Yeah, there are socioeconomic sort of criminal hotspots. So
and therefore, it is perhaps when, if you're in some areas, you may well finish up in a situation like this where you think, yeah, you know, I'm dealing with this day in, day out, and I've got, you know, and I'm used to having families that don't really have that much support, etc., etc. Whereas there are other areas where, you know, this is a woman who doesn't have any support networks, and therefore you might have expected that they would have picked up on it even more, although to be fair, they were treating her.
Well, I do wonder as well whether there's an element of I mean the sort of the euphemism that is baby blues. I sometimes wonder whether that is used too euphemistically. It is frequently, and in fact the expression I think originally comes from frankly it's what postnatal depression used to be called.
It is.
And it's still used now in a sort of vaguely sort of reassuring way, I think, is the intention.
Well, I think the reason for that is because baby blues probably predominantly kicks in, A, because you've got hormones raging through your body in a manner in which it is not, it's quite frankly not natural. I don't know. Possibly be right.
You
invented this pregnancy nonsense. So you've got that to deal with. And obviously you've had one set of hormones, and after about 4 years, you're saying 4 days, it all suddenly changes. So you've got that to deal with. But you've also got an incredible lack of sleep, and it is no surprise that sleep deprivation is regarded as a form of torture.
Yeah.
So you're going through this torture at the same time you've got all these hormones raising through your body. The thing about baby blues is those two things tend to go away. Baby eventually sleeps and the hormones settle down. So on the whole, there you've got your baby blues. It probably will go away, but you know, if it doesn't, it's because it's not baby
you've
blues.
You've also got sort of tied in with that, and it's interesting actually, whilst researching this a little bit, what I have also found is that there's quite a lot of research at the moment into the male hormonal response to a new baby in the household. And it's interesting
also
because, well, other than sleep deprivation, which I guess is just, I mean, that's anyone
what
in the
happens.
Household.
Anyone
I imagine your dog was probably suffering from sleep deprivation initially.
I think the whole neighbourhood was, in fairness.
I didn't want to say, but for those who hadn't gathered, Lexi and I live very close to each other. The research seems to now be supporting what I think has probably been known for quite a long time, which is that male hormonal response to pregnancy and then to a child being born, it kind of switches from being massively testosterone fueled to being practically sort of zero testosterone. It's massively reduced as a physiological response to it, which can quite severely unbalance some men, it turns out.
Yeah.
So you've also, if you're the mum in that situation, you're also dealing with a bloke who's really not kind of,
I think, useless in the medical term.
That's the one, yeah.
I don't think you noticed that, though, to be honest.
As readers of your blog would call him the Irish one, I'm sure you
coped
fine.
Yeah, my blog, I call him the Irish one. He gets a lot of grief on my blog, but he, I mean, I agree with that, and I can actually, having heard that now for the first time, I think, yeah, I mean, when we came home from hospital, the Irish one decided that we were to work in shifts. to make sure that he was always
very logical.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, and I just went along with it because I was just a blundering mess at this point anyway. And so one of us was always awake with him, so we would literally work in shifts. So we didn't have a conversation for 2 weeks.
Yes, it's really great, your relationship. Yes.
Oh God, it was.
Sounds like quite a good idea to me,
wasn't it? at the time, it was horrific. Now we no longer do that. Some days I think back to it and think, oh, but I mean, I think the tiredness, it does, you know, and I think they do. They have a, I mean, without a doubt, the Irish one, he had a reaction to Addison coming home, without a doubt. And I think the two of us, I remember him saying to me, very, very lovingly, as we were standing over the cot, this is going to make me sound really selfish, but I'm going to blame the illness for it. Now I know what real love is. And I wanted to punch him in the face.
That's not the illness.
With a broken bottom is the politest way of putting it. Not having been able to sit down or go to the loo for 2 weeks and a body that has been taken over by this monster. And I was just like, excuse me? And so, yeah, I agree. They do become more useless. Is it the testosterone that...
apparently that's the reason. Yeah, it's the cut in.
But I mean, I think going back to what you were saying earlier about areas and where she lived and what have you, I have to be quite honest. I mean, I suffered through an awful lot for the first year of Addison's life, and I was being treated predominantly by the National Health. And the only thing I got off the National Health really was a packet full of antipsychotics and a packet full of antidepressants and a counselling lady. I was sent for counselling, and on one of the sessions, and this is no lie, no exaggeration, and I write about this quite funnily on my blog, she fell asleep. So I was sitting talking to her.
It's hard not to take that personally.
I know, it can be a bit boring occasionally.
Happens to Mr. Knight in court all the time. Juries, judges.
I've only lost one juror.
And I was like, what do you do when your counsellor falls asleep? What do you actually do? Do I get up and leave? Or anyway,
heavy book dropped onto the desk in front of you is the traditional way.
And, the best thing to do is apparently is, you drop something heavy on the table, and as they wake up with a start, the next thing out of your mouth is, and that's why I killed her.
That's totally why I should.
The joy of hindsight.
But yeah, and nothing was happening. The counselling wasn't working and what have you, and I'd been into A&E a couple of times. By this point, I'd already taken one overdose and was well on my way to the second, was planning it. And it was at that point that the Irish one, or my other half, he got in touch with somebody where I worked. I was lucky enough at that time. I was off on maternity leave, but I've worked for quite a large medical insurer here in England for quite a long time.
Sorry, we're not the BBC. You can say Bupa.
Bupa. I don't really want to. to be fair, they've just made me redundant, so, you know. But anyway.
Well, in that case, other private medical insurers.
And basically he got in touch with them, and I was admitted through them. It was Bupa that sorted everything out. The reason why I had a voluntary section was because Bupa got involved.
Well, I must admit, I wondered in this case, because I don't want to denigrate the husband in this case at all, but there's the whole thing about, you know, he was very supportive and all the rest. But you do wonder, you know, if he was that worried about her, perhaps the key here is, why didn't he know that was a step he could take? And maybe he just didn't know that was
maybe
a step he could take.
But also, and I have to say, and again, completely agree with you, but also, Alan... Oh, I've named him. He's going to kill me. Just wipe that bit out. Said that. He's not really called Alan. He's called Frank. He basically had no idea that there was anything wrong with me, because I were, other than obviously when he got home and I spent £8,000 on his credit card at that point, that was a warning sign. But I mean, up until that point, and that we're talking 11 months in by that point, because he would say to me,
he's been living with it,
because he was saying to me, is everything okay? And then by the time he got home from work, I was, yeah, fine, and this is what we've done and this is what we've done. And he would leave the house and I'd be self-harming and crying all day and not being able to cope and planning ways of jumping in front of trains or driving my car into a wall at 90 miles an hour, absolutely anguished all day. But the minute he walked through that door, I put on a show like you wouldn't believe.
Well,
why?
Because you don't want to put it on him either, do you?
Well, I didn't want him to think that I was too much trouble and leave me.
Yes.
Because if he left me, and this is the honest God's truth, if he left me with the baby, then what would I have done? Mm. And for me at that point, I could have, people were coming around, and this is going to sound horrific, but this is part of the illness as it was, is I didn't want Addison. I didn't want him. I was stuck with him all day and I didn't want him. I could have quite happily given him away.
Well, to be fair,
point.
That's actually not that unusual either. It's one of the things, and this happens with people who've only got baby blues, as I understand it as well, is you talk to virtually most mothers actually have at some point thought about throwing the child down the stairs, out the window, smothering it.
I mean,
so
like,
it's not actually, it's very tricky to then diagnose what is baby blues, what is postnatal blues. I mean, and the only thing you've got really is how long has it been going on for?
Yeah. I never wanted to harm him. That was never in my head. I loved him. I loved him so much from you know, but I didn't want him. I was quite happy to love him.
You just wanted to love him from a distance, somehow.
You know, really. And I think I didn't want Alan. One of the reasons why I didn't want it's fine. I've named him now. I didn't want him to know that I was such an evil, horrible person. So when he came home, I would put on the show because I didn't want him to know how much I didn't want my baby. Because gosh, what kind of person doesn't want their baby? And so again, it's that. Now, if I had had killed, you know, awful to think of, if I had killed Addison, if I had smothered Addison or done something to Addison, I know Alan, as I know him now, would have absolutely stood by me. Because he would have seen it. Knowing what he knows now, having seen me go kicking and screaming into hospital under the section and having me screaming down the phone, I don't want to stay, I can't believe you're doing this to me. And having me, as I got more and more well on the medication and through talk therapy, heard some of the things that I told him that I was feeling and what I was going through, and he was absolutely gobsmacked, could not believe that I'd been going through that because he had no idea. I know for in a heartbeat, if I'd have some way harmed Addison, he would be sticking by me just the way Felicia Boots is, because he recognises now that it was an illness, that it wasn't my choice that I was making.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should have a look at a quick look at the law.
Yes, absolutely. Go on, crack on. I was about to say that there's a, because we're running a little bit long time, but I was about to say that people may also remember the Fiona Donison.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to have a look at.
Yeah.
This obviously, the Boots case is quite specific, and everybody seems to be of the opinion, and you know, including the jury, that she was suffering from diminished responsibility. I was asking earlier about whether we thought that was a right way to deal with things in the criminal justice system. I think it has to be said, frequently, the only way quite a lot of people get help in this country is by committing some kind of crime and finding themselves in the criminal justice system. So, for example, if you are homeless, you cannot have a treating psychiatrist because you can't then have help on the NHS if you're homeless, which is
so sad.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I've had clients beg me in criminal cases for psychological or psychiatric reports because it's the only way they think they'll ever get to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist.
Sometimes the only way to do it is to do something serious enough to find yourself into strange ways so that you can then at least you've got to treat things. You've got, yes, it's, you know, and the criminal justice system, for all the criticisms levelled at it, is actually one of the best ways of getting the help that you need in this
country.
It's absolutely appalling, but it's true.
Around Christmas time, I'm just trying to think when the podcast will resume. Probably before Christmas.
No,
I wonder if we'll be able to cover it then, but I always notice around Christmas time a peak in low-level offending. Really minor shoplifts, enough to get the attention of the police, so that over the Christmas period people can have a roof over
their heads. I'm just bearing this in mind for when my medical insurance runs out.
So that's that.
Assisting an offender times three.
The other way in which the criminal justice in particularly recognises this, although in this case it wasn't used, is a very rarely used act, which is the infanticide.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is infanticide. As it happens in Felicia Boots' case, it wouldn't have helped her as a defence with one of the children because one of them was 14 months old. Well done, Jonathan.
Sorry, something in North Pod Towers just broke. Oh, I don't even know what it was.
Anyway, I actually think this is something that perhaps possibly needs a bit of a revision. She pleaded diminished responsibility, but she could have pleaded, or in fact the judge actually was probably under a duty to put to the jury that she was actually guilty of infanticide, which is specifically a law which enables you, if you have killed a child who is under the age of 12 months, your own child, you have to be the mother.
Yep.
And the reason for so doing was that you were suffering at the time from the effects of the birth or lactation. That is infanticide. It's not
And how is that dealt with differently by law?
Well, it's no different from diminished responsibility, but it is specifically there not to say that you were a bit balmy for whatever reason, but to say you were suffering from postnatal depression brought on entirely because of the effects of pregnancy, of the birth.
And as well, what's interesting is, like you say, Kirsten, it's a question of directions, because it can be charged as an offence in its own right.
It can, but it doesn't have to
but
be.
But if you charge with the murder of your own child, if the criteria are all fit and you charge with murder or manslaughter, this is, well, it appears to be an alternative verdict.
It's an alternative verdict. It's not a defence. In the same way, actually, diminished responsibility is not a whole defence. It's partial defence.
Yeah.
Infanticide is an alternative charge, but it does show that actually, in law, it is recognised that this is.
But again, a disposal would have been.
Disposal would.
In these circumstances,
and in fact, it would be very hard to work out. I think it would be even harder in a case of infanticide to say that there should be any other form of punishment, I think it's such an emotive phrase, infanticide. I don't know whether that's why people shy away from it, but actually, I think if you see that on somebody's record, you would immediately know that this person wasn't really that criminal, haven't been really criminally
culpable,
responsible yet for what they do. And
which makes you think, potentially in cases where you haven't got a judge who is as on board as this judge was in relation to the method of disposal, a plea to something like infanticide, when you've got maybe a diagnosis of postnatal psychosis as well. Well, it's your guarantee, isn't it? It's your guaranteed hospital order.
Well, it's not, because you can get life imprisonment for infanticide.
Of course, but as opposed to murder.
Well, indeed,
you can get life imprisonment.
You can. It's hard to see why you would, but yes, you can. Perhaps would depend on what you did, I suppose, and how you went on. But it is markedly different than manslaughter on your record.
What's interesting,
if you looked at it,
well,
you'd know immediately as a practitioner that, when your client says, yes, it was my child, you wouldn't even need to ask. It's there on the record. It's immediately obvious what it is.
It also opens up child destruction, because if you charge infanticide, child destruction is an alternative to infanticide. So that makes me wonder whether or not in circumstances like this it would be more appropriate still.
You can't have child destruction.
In what respect?
Because the child hadn't got child's already got a separate existence.
Well, yes.
Good point. Cord is cut, child is alive. Yeah. But anyway.
Sorry.
But nice thinking.
Cheers.
I think that the fact that the law just it does bring to task that the law does recognise it. And the other thing, point I wanted to make out is, yes, there are other cases where this happens. And it is perhaps... It's difficult when you see the Felicia Boots case, you think, really, what was she doing being dealt with at all by a court? Mm. But when you then look at other cases, there's a case in Spain.
This is the Fiona Donison case,
she is called... I have it here. But while I'm just looking for this, do you think that she shouldn't have... Because I do still believe that she should have been dealt with by a court.
No, I think she should have been as well. But one of the reasons I think she should have been is because I think it is for the court to decide. It's for a jury, really, to make those decisions.
Is it, though?
I think it is. I think it's very difficult because... Well, okay, there are probably some cases where it's not... But there are a lot of cases, it's such an emotive thing. You've killed two children. And in her case, one of them was over the 12 months old. But, the public outcry of somebody killing their children is just astonishing.
Catastrophic and horrific. And I completely, completely agree. And there was a part of me when I first read it that I thought, and I looked at the pictures of the children, and I thought, you evil. And then I thought, hang back. Let's read this, because that is. But
you then finish it with the case I was talking about, the Spanish one, is Leanne Smith.
Sorry, yes, that's right.
To be fair, I don't know what the outcome of this is. Not because I just don't know, but because actually there is no outcome to
not
this
yet,
at the moment.
No.
But it's being dealt with in a Spanish court.
But she is actually British, isn't she?
She's British. She was, I think, on holiday. I'm fairly certain she was on holiday. And she smothered, again, two children, left them in the bed. There were issues in the Felicia Boots case with them, the manner in which she dealt with the children. She'd sort of laid them out rather beautifully and all the rest of it, whereas this was sort of just sort of vaguely left in the bed, I think. And then she very calmly went downstairs and said she needed to speak to the police. The jury is out, so to speak, or rather the courts are out, as to whether she is guilty of Well, whether she, in effect, whether it's diminished responsibility or whether she has murdered these two children.
In cold blood.
In cold blood.
But had she murdered them in cold blood, then surely she wouldn't have gone down. So, well, I always think of, as a layperson, well, I'm not a lawyer, so hands up here for that. But I always think if something's cold blood or something's premeditated like that, then if it's cold blood, then it's premeditated.
I find
she's not going to do it on holiday in bed. She's going to wait until they're swimming in a lake somewhere and she can just say they've drowned.
Well, yes, but there's cold blood premeditated and there's losing temper and doing something in the heat of the moment or whatever. It's always very hard to tell.
Yeah.
And this is why, actually, I think it probably is the court system may well be the right place for it. I mean, perhaps they could do something rather better than the manner in which it's dealt with, but
it's just so sad. All of it is just so unbelievably
sad. But then
sad.
You move on to the Fiona Donison case, don't you? Where she was found guilty of murder. And she was found guilty of murder because, and in her case, she went into the police station. She went in to the police station, told the officers she'd killed her children. She'd folded
them up in the boot of her car.
She'd folded them up into holdalls in the boot of her car. Now, again, I think it's always very difficult, this, because I have absolutely no idea how I would react after having just killed my child or anybody, actually. But we put so much emphasis on how people deal with things afterwards. But in that case, there was evidence as well that she had done it not out of postnatal depression, but because she actually wanted to get back at her husband. They'd split up and it seemed a really good way of hurting him. And whether
Don't
she actually...
Your children, there must be some sort of diminished... I mean, to think that there must be some sort of psychiatric issue anyway to start with, because, I mean, those are your children. I mean, I get back at Alan by burning his tea. I don't get back at him by... You know what I mean? I wouldn't... I mean, and I have psychosis. I wouldn't want to get back...
Equally, most people who finish up murdering...
I don't cook Alan tea.
Most people who murder people, you could claim the same thing for people who go around cold-bloodedly killing people.
Oh, I suppose you could. I don't tend to spend a lot of time thinking about them.
Well, in any event, there are reviews flowing from both the Donison case, and presumably I think there'll probably be some sort of review from the Boots case. But
I'd like to see a review of the infanticide law to extend it beyond a year, I have to say. I think 12 months is just... now we've got a better understanding of postnatal depression and how long it lasts for.
I wonder whether the Law Commission might ultimately look into this as a bigger issue. Anywho, crikey, listeners, we've got to...
rattle on.
But most of our show through. Right, okay. Jonathan, AM.
AM is an interesting case because it reminds
me... It better be now. You've built it up.
Well, yes. It reminds me of the multi-hole problem where you're given three doors and there's a donkey behind one and all you have to do is pick the door that doesn't... Any door that doesn't have a donkey behind. So you start off and you say, I'll have door number one. There's no donkey behind it. And
hurrah!
The presenter then says, right, I can tell you there's no donkey behind door number one. You can either stick... Oh, that's not how it goes at all. Anyway, it's a very interesting problem. But the point is...
So it's not just the judge who didn't understand it.
Shall I have a slight explanation? The probability of you not picking the donkey is different after you've picked one of the doors.
Yeah.
Yes. You pick it's called
to do with Bayesian statistical problems, which is rubbish.
Yeah.
I'm not a Bayesian.
Okay.
If anybody who's out there is a mathematician. Anybody who isn't a mathematician will not have understood a word of that.
I'm just going to try and write it in basic
Jonathan,
right.
Let's talk about the law of it, Jonathan. What actually happened?
I could have fixed that. 10 seconds. Right. So effectively, what happened in this case was a jury had been sworn in, and then it turned out that one of the members of that jury had insufficiently proficient English.
The trial had actually started.
Only just. Yeah. So you've got 1 out of 12 not good enough in English, and everyone's concerned that he wouldn't be able to do justice to the case.
Yeah.
Fine.
So what do we do?
Discharge one juror. But then the question becomes, what do you then do?
Do you discharge one juror, or do you
re-empanel 12, mix your 11 back in with the whole pool, and pick another 12 from scratch?
Because we're a little stuck for time, I shall say this. So the trial had already just started, but the judge told the remaining 11 jurors that they would be brought back and picked again, being moved, and he said they're on the open panel. That's that. Prosecutor then entered, and it's important it was only the prosecutor who entered into an exchange initially with the judge about what to do next. The prosecutor had raised a bit of a concern about it, but ultimately had agreed that there was quite big concerns,
because his concern was that, and this is the nub of the case really, a jury has to be chosen by random. if you have already picked 11 of your jurors...
They're pre-selected and therefore not random.
They're not random anymore. Is that a problem? I mean, pragmatically, obviously, anybody looking at this is likely to think, yeah, do you know what, not so much, because they've just been picked and they're still kind of... they're not mathematically random people off, mm-hmm. off the street.
Well, they're but actually,
for your average Joe public... They are kind of random,
They're random for the purposes of Section 18 of the Juries Act 1974, is the point. They were.
Well, they were initially.
The panel. Then the question was whether they ultimately were.
Are they still random?
Yeah.
And the judge said, OK, I've done this before. Yes, I'm quite happy with that. The prosecution raised an objection. Defence were asked their opinion. Mm. And they kind of said, yeah,
defense said,
we don't mind.
And then raised it on appeal.
Yes.
Well, so raised on appeal. Defence counsel had, as I say, been asked for his observations. He raised or authority actually to suggest, if you read the judgment very carefully, to suggest that due process may actually be a problem.
Yes, he's saying
in fairness to the defence counsel,
he does say that.
He does. Anyway, Court of Appeal then seized of the matter and asked whether the principle of random selection had been offended. The answer is yes, and that's based on another binding authority on them, another Court of Appeal decision.
Yep.
Their language rather suggested to me they didn't agree with the authority that preceded it, but there you go.
I think the fact that the charge was rather a serious one, it was a rape, and it was quite serious, and I think they were therefore probably quite terrified.
Well,
they may have to discharge.
The opponents had administered chloroform to his wife
and then raped her on two occasions.
Yeah,
it was quite
a funky
one.
It's like
Dallas.
Isn't our lives
like that?
That's what we do. So it's a really serious, charge, and I think the Court of Appeal probably terrified of saying, yes, the whole thing could just disappear on the basis of this really rather stupid thing that's happened. But the Juries Act actually covers them in any event, doesn't it?
It does.
Go on, you've got it in front of you.
I don't anymore. I've moved it aside and I've got to look at my next night's carry on.
It basically says...
Are we talking about Section 11.1 of the Juries Act?
Right.
Okay, so the court concludes that the judge failed to comply with Section 11.1 of the Juries Act 1974, breach of the balloting requirement.
There's a big but that basically says if you haven't objected to it...
Right, I think that's when you come to...
If the defence doesn't actually make any objection to it, then that's the end of that, then.
Yeah, point very simply was that because it... Yeah, exactly, it was the defence advocate to have raised it as an issue at the time of... The wording, I can't remember exactly, but it's the time of trial or...
Yes, it has to be an objection.
It's clear counsel for the appellant cannot rely on objections to potentially regularities to the process raised by counsel for the Crown unless he expressly adopts them for himself.
I think this is this case going further.
He cannot at this stage, when counsel for the Crown raise these concerns, having listened to them, simply take either a neutral or uncommitted stance to possible irregularity and then follow a conviction, rely upon it as a basis for circumventing the prohibition.
The difficulty here is it was a bit of an on the hoof thing for the defence counsel to give him his due.
Kick off.
Oh, actually, I would say if in doubt, ask for a moment to have a think about it would be the... if I were talking to...
Possibly to take some instructions from your client as to whether he's got any objections might think would be the way forward.
But it's all very well sitting around in North Pod Towers contemplating that over a glass of wine. If you're in court in that situation, then it may not be so easy. I don't know if it was a trial judge. I don't know whether he was the sort of fellow who would have done the right thing.
He said he'd done it several times before.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, there you go.
The moral of the story is object if you're not sure, object to it at that point, because then you have got an appeal point, whereas you haven't if you...
Yes, well, indeed. Don't lose an appeal point.
Okay.
Ben, tell us about the CRB.
I shall indeed. Right, so this is to do with disclosure of, criminal convictions and other information about you as part of an enhanced criminal records certificate check. That's the ECRC, what you would probably call CRB check in other parlance. This is the enhanced one that doesn't just include convictions, though, as I say, includes other behaviour, other information held by the police that is relevant. I'm not going to give you the full details of the case because we ain't got time, basically, but this is the Queen on the application of J against the Chief Constable of Devon and Cornwall. If you want the citation, it'll be in the show notes, I'm sure, but it's 2012 VWHC 2996 Admin Court. Long story short, J is a Zimbabwean nurse in her mid-30s. I don't know why that was relevant in the judgment, but it was. Arrived in the UK in 2004, qualified as a nurse in 1999, worked in various nursing homes, experience with the mentally ill, terminally ill, those with learning difficulties, so on and so forth. She had a caution in 2005 for child cruelty, which really wasn't relevant. It was a case of leaving her son alone for longer than was appropriate on a single occasion.
Right.
That was always showing up in her...
That's not going to go away, is it?
...results, and no quite, but she took no issue with that. The problem was that in 2011, she applied for three different jobs in different places, and on the ECRC that came back for that, it recorded, and in fact I'll give you the wording of it, it says, in February 2007, a complaint was made to the police alleging that Jay had assaulted a female elderly lady who was resident at the residential home which employed her. Police visited the elderly lady, who did not wish to make an official complaint, but stated that she felt that Jay was too severe and heavy-handed, although she apologised to the lady when she pointed out that her actions hurt her. No police action was taken, and the residential home reported to police that they were to arrange some manual handling training for Jay. In June 2011...
So what was the charge? What was the proposed charge there? It would have been
assault. Well, there wasn't. No, yeah, if anything, it would have been assault.
It was an allegation of assault.
There was nothing at all, yeah. In 2011, so the first one's 2007. This is 2011. Police receive a complaint that Jay has allegedly mistreated a resident at a home for the blind. It was alleged that the resident lady had asked Jay for assistance in sitting up, to which Jay is alleged to have grabbed the lady by the head and pulled her up. Police wanted to interview the lady, but due to her being very ill and subsequently dying, that wasn't possible. I should point out that wasn't as a result of the...
No, of course,
just
yes.
To be very clear.
Glad you pointed that out.
Yeah, quite important detail. Police, two other residents had also made a complaint about mistreatment from Jay, but due to their dementia, they were not considered reliable witnesses. There was also another element, which I don't think was reported in there, which was to do with a male resident who... it seems there'd been some sort of racist behaviour towards her, and he seems to have been something of a rabble-rouser by the sounds of it. But anyway, that wasn't included in the ECRC. It was just information the police held. In relation to that 2011 one, though, she was interviewed by the police regarding the incidents, which she categorically denied. Police were advised... that Jay subsequently left that employment, which she did, only because the shift pattern was no use to her.
Okay.
All right, so 2011 then, so she makes these applications. This is where listeners to last week's show would find this familiar. Jay was not informed that these new elements were going to be added to the ECRC when she made the application, and she had no opportunity to make representations about it. So the question was, should she have been given that right?
Yeah.
Well, the Royal College of Nurses stepped in 2012 in January and sent a pre-action letter to the Chief Constable.
Pre-action for JR?
On behalf of Jay, saying the information may have been accurate in the narrowest sense, i.e. that complaints had been made, but the disclosure of the allegations, unproved and largely uninvestigated, was disproportionate. I'm not going to trawl through all of the details. It's actually a very interesting judgment, and you probably should read it. In fact, maybe my summary might be available in the show notes, possibly, yeah. Long story short, the deal was that it's a balancing exercise, which you may remember from last week's show. The balance is between the potential risk to vulnerable adults in this particular case, although it could be children, from not disclosing the allegations, versus the Article 8 right to private life of the job applicant. And very simply, what the court in the High Court in this case said was, well, the law's been decided since the case of L and the Commissioner for the Metropolis in 2009. That was a Supreme Court case. Which basically says, right, no blanket and sweeping approaches to be taken to this, every case on its merits, balance up the various factors. First step, look at whether the allegations are even relevant to the application that's being made. Secondly, if they are relevant, then consider if they ought to be disclosed. It will have to be, as well, and this is what Elle told us, it's not enough to say, well, these are vulnerable people, therefore that's the overriding right. No, absolutely not. It is not a blanket overriding right.
But it can't be, because then there's no balancing exercise.
No, although if...
I suppose they're saying that sometimes the balance is so farly tipped one way. That's their argument.
And oddly enough, that's kind of what part of this decision came down to, because part of the decision was, in a case where there is no... obvious, clear, unchallengeable view that these allegations must be right, but are not convictions, then there's perhaps no duty there, perhaps, to consult the subject of the ECRC.
I love the golden thread that runs through criminal justice of innocent until proven guilty. It's great.
You say that, but this is a very good thing. I'm now trying to find the part of the judgment, because I'm now skipping through it because of the problems with timing. Yeah, the court said that it was clearly a borderline decision in this case. The decision maker should have sought Jay's views prior to disclosure. Moreover, the 2007 matters had not been disclosed on ECRCs in the past.
No,
it was the presence of the 2011 matters that the chief constable said gravitated towards disclosure of both sets of allegations. High Court said no, that's flawed logic.
Yeah.
The fact that you've got one set of potentially untrue allegations in 2007, the fact that you then got another set of them in 2011 that are potentially untrue as well, how does that in any way make the 2007 ones more relevant?
We do just get to the no smoke without fire section, don't we?
We do indeed. It was interesting as well to note that the court offered this guidance. The judge says, whilst it would offend the proposition that all cases are fact specific, to say that in all cases of that nature, the opportunity to make representation should be given before disclosure of the material is made, it must be in very few such cases that such an opportunity should not be given. There may be very good reasons, not immediately apparent to the decision maker, for taking a different view. That really is the point of this judgment. The law is really quite settled as per the Supreme Court's account, but here the High Court's offering a little bit of assistance with just understanding how settled the law is, and saying, no, yeah, there may well be situations where, it's possible that you don't need to have a consultation, but in this case, and in most cases, you will have to make a consultation with the person whose disclosure you're making.
Yeah.
A couple of interesting features to this, which probably didn't help the Chief Constable, I think it's fair to say, is that when the Royal College of Nurses made their representations on it, that triggered a review system within the police with the disclosure officer. And in fact, an independent disclosure officer in this case reviewed it and said, there is nowhere on this earth you should be making these disclosures. Of reasons, all of which were perfectly sensible, about, lack of supporting evidence, the fact the allegations had been considered, sorry, the residents who'd given their accounts had been considered unreliable, and so on and so forth. All of that was seemingly ignored. The Chief Constable, in fact, it was a DSI who was standing in place of the Chief Constable, had simply read it all and said, yes, that's all very interesting. I see you're well-crafted and wholly reasonable, as he described it, thought process, but I'm going to ignore it and substitute mine back in. Not good enough, says the High Court. So that's a bit of a contrast, perhaps, to the case we covered last week. But there you go. Right, very briefly, Williams, and then we've got to go because it's the end of the series and I need to go and catch my bus.
Indeed.
Or something.
Orrett Williams, charged with possession of a prohibitive weapon, was also originally charged with having a firearm with the intention to cause fear of violence. Very briefly, the facts are that at 2:20 a.m. Some men arrived at Mr. Williams's house. His wife or partner or girlfriend, I'm not quite sure which, gave a full comment interview because she was arrested in regard to this as well. And she stated that she'd seen a masked man approaching the flat. She was scared, told the appellant they were about to be robbed. So he came out, he had an imitation firearm, fired some blanks at them, and unfortunately the masked men weren't masked men. They turned out to be the police.
Oops.
Yes. The case turns, this is on the law, really. The trial judge, Judge Gerald, sitting at the Inner London Crown Court, had rejected the submission that an issue having been duly raised, as was common ground, as to whether the appellant knew or had reason to suspect that the imitation firearm was readily convertible, which is the charge with which he has to... the matter with which he was charged. It was then for the prosecution to make the jury sure that the appellant did not know and had no reason to suspect that it was readily convertible.
Mm-hmm.
So the question for the Court of Appeal was, upon whom is the burden of proof? Is it a legal burden or a persuasive burden?
And what was the answer?
Well,
No. Just what was the answer?
Well, the law says, in any proceedings brought by virtue of that section, it shall be a defence for the accused to show that he did not know and had no reason to suspect that the imitation firearm was so constructed or adapted as to be readily convertible into a firearm to which that act applies.
So for him to show.
You might think.
That's kind of what the law says.
Yeah, you might think that that would be straightforward. The Court of Appeal do go on about it being a balancing act, and it depends on how serious the matter is and such like. So that perhaps raises issues in other cases where you may think it's not necessarily that straightforward. What is interesting in this case is the Crown called a forensic scientist, Mr. Gibbs, and he goes on, he gave quite lengthy evidence about what he had to do in order to actually convert this weapon into a workable firearm.
Yeah.
There was some issue as to whether you could do it with things that you would, one would have lying around the house in terms of DIY equipment, but to be fair, I think it would be fair to say you could probably get them at B&Q.
It's like the crocodile clips and 9-volt battery taser cases.
Yes, you may not have them at home lying around, but you probably could get hold of them at some DIY shop. But what was particularly interesting was that after disassembly and conversion, he carried out a search on the internet and spent 3 to 4 hours and was not able to find any information stating or suggesting that this item was convertible. So you do...
So technically it was convertible.
He had to take it apart in order to determine that it was convertible, and he's a firearms expert. So you do find yourself thinking, novel decision by the jury, possibly.
You might
possibly.
Want to add the word readily convertible in there somewhere,
I don't like suggesting that it's interesting, having read it, I have great queries over whether the jury got this right. But that's not, of course, a matter for the Court of Appeal. The matter was, should it have gone to the jury in the manner in which it does, and the point of the case is, yes, it should. In the case of firearms, where it's readily convertible, it is for the defence to show that it... That the defendant didn't know or didn't suspect. It is not for the prosecution to prove it.
Bit of a weird one, isn't it?
It's a very strange case. It's a really good read, but the point is very, very simple.
Fair enough. All right, well, we're completely out of time.
We are entirely out of time.
We are, indeed. You can hear because there's the music.
We're back for one episode before Christmas, and then I'm not quite sure what's happening after that.
It's some of
us,
the unknown.
Some of us will be on maternity leave.
That'll be me. Lexi, thank you very much for joining us on the show. Where can people find your blog?
That would be, just type Mammy Woo into Google. That's the easiest way of finding me.
Indeedy doodly. If you want to contact us before next series, find us on Twitter, the usual place. In fact, you know where to find us. It's already there. We're going to go now because it's the end of the series. Goodbye.
If in doubt, kick off.
Absolutely.
That's the lesson I've learned.
That's what you need to do.